Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. The National Climate Assessment is out, and no news here, it's not good. Summers are longer and hotter, winters are shorter and warmer. Ditto for New Mexico. But what exactly does this mean for us, and can renewables bend the climate change curve? Today we'll be joined by two Los Alamos scientists with answers to these very questions. First up is Dr. Nate McDowell, a plant physiologist, on how New Mexico's trees will fare if climate change continues at its current pace. Nate McDowell, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate your invitation.
So Nate, if you could tell me why this experiment, what did you hope to learn from it and what did you learn from it?
Well, the experiments that we've been conducting where we drought and heat trees are designed really to allow us to address two problems. The first problem is that while everybody knows that when droughts come, bark beetles show up and trees die.
Yeah, I can look outside my house, right? My neighbor has two trees that are dying from drought and heat.
Right. I mean, it's no surprise, but nobody can predict it at all. Globally, in the world, there's nobody that can predict this. So that means we have a fundamental science question that's worth pursuing. You know, if you can't predict it, you don't understand it.
When you say you can't predict it, what exactly do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, and that's the second thing, is that in order to inform policymakers and managers of landscapes, we need to be able to tell them what's coming, right? And so it's really important to be able to make predictions about how will the forest be surviving or dying in the future. And so that's the second really big goal of ours, is to do these experiments in order to test hypotheses about how trees die, ultimately to make better models.
I see. All right. So what were the drought and heat parameters for your experiment?
For the current experiment, we've reduced precipitation from whatever falls on the ground. We take away about 40% of it using gutters located below the canopy but above the ground. And the heat is 5 Celsius, or about 9 Fahrenheit, above ambient temperature. So whatever the temperature is outside, add 9 Fahrenheit, and that's what these trees are experiencing.
So where do these parameters come from? What's the base?
Yeah, sure. So the precipitation comes from historical knowledge. We know during previous droughts that rainfall was about, and snowfall was about, 50% of the long-term average. So that's what we're trying to do, is to reduce precipitation between 40 and 50%, assuming that we're going to be still hitting the long-term average over a bunch of years. And the temperature comes from a couple of things. We know that when trees died in the 2000 to 2003 drought here in New Mexico, that temperature was a couple of degrees Celsius warmer than average. So you think about the year 2050 or 2070, it's going to be more than just a couple of degrees warmer than it has been historically. It'll be 3 to 4 degrees warmer Celsius. Plus, during a heat wave, you add another Celsius, right? That's how we decided on 9 Fahrenheit or 5 Celsius.
So all these assumptions are sort of based on climate change and that man, that it's anthropogenic, that man is causing climate change. And I want to just directly address that question with you, because there are so-called climate change deniers, people who say that man is not causing climate change. So here's my question. We know that in the lab, CO2 is a heat-trapping gas. We know that there's been more CO2 emitted since the Industrial Revolution. It's been measured by NASA, by other organizations. There's a lot more being emitted. We know there's a lot more in the atmosphere. A lot's been absorbed, but there's a lot more in the atmosphere. So my question is, what's the argument for those that deny that man is causing climate change?
There isn't one. There is no scientifically real argument to deny that anthropogenic CO2 emissions are driving the huge majority of climate change.
So when they say something like 97% of scientists agree, what are the 3% saying?
Those are the 3% that are largely funded by private think tanks, right? Mm-hmm. And they're coming up with one excuse or another. Anybody can say, yeah, there's a mistake in this data set, or there's errors in those measurements. And those things are true. But when you have hundreds, if not thousands, of published papers that all say basically the same thing, it's undeniable evidence.
All right. I mean, they say things like there's, you know, the Earth's warm, the Earth's cool, it goes through phases. But none of that changes the fact that we're loading the atmosphere with CO2, which is a heat-trapping gas, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it is very true to say that the Earth has always gone through ups and downs in precipitation and temperature. But those ups and downs have been tightly correlated with the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere.
I see. So really, it supports the idea. It doesn't detract from it. That man.
No.
Okay.
No,
so let's talk about your experiment then. So tell us more about exactly what you did and how the experiment went.
Well, the experiment's still ongoing, but what we've done is we've put these drought structures out across the landscape in a pinyon juniper woodland. And the drought structures remove rainfall and snowfall. And the reason we chose pinyon and juniper is because pinyon pines tend to die during drought, and junipers tend to survive. So they're a nice comparison.
I see.
They're a nice comparison. It's also widespread throughout the Southwest, so it's an important couple of species to those of us who live here. And they're easy to work in because they're short. I did my PhD on old-growth Douglas fir in Washington, so this has been a really nice change, is that we can actually reach the canopies of these trees.
I see. And how many trees were involved, what have you found so far, I guess?
There's 80 trees involved in this particular study. And what we've found in general from our drought experiments is that, you know, of course, drought kills trees. And we found that we can predict it pretty darn well if we know how much carbohydrates the trees have. So that's kind of like our version of fat. That's what they store mm-hmm. to survive. And so the less carbohydrates they have, the more starvation that they've undergone, which I can describe if you wish, the more likely they are to die.
So why do they starve?
Well, why they starve is a cool thing to us physiologists. Is they when a drought comes, trees, you know, they can't go get a drink of water like we can. So what they do is they have these little pores on their leaves called stomata. And these pores allow water to leave, and they allow CO2 to enter so photosynthesis can occur. Well, what they do during a drought is they close those pores to prevent water loss. It's as if we could stop sweating, right, to survive without water. But the problem with that is that they've also, since those pores are functionally their mouths, they've cut off their ability to eat. They've cut off the ability for CO2 to diffuse into the leaf where photosynthesis can occur. So at that point, they're stuck living off their reserves as if we weren't eating. And what happens then is, just like humans or other mammals or all organisms, you know, the longer you go without consuming resources, without eating, the more vulnerable you are to things like bark beetles and pathogens. So humans can die of the common cold if they haven't eaten in a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or of pneumonia. We don't die of starvation outright, but we die of some disease that we're just vulnerable to because our resources are down. And it's the same with trees.
So how long has this experiment been going on for?
Well, we actually have two. We had one in central New Mexico at the Sevierta, and that's been going on 8 years. And then we have the one where we're actually heating trees as well.
Okay.
And that's in its third year.
So this is the one where you've heated it about 9 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, and that's in its third year.
So are any of the trees that are being heated, have any of them made it? Have any of them survived?
Well, they look terrible. Their leaves are falling off, and they look like they're pretty haggard. But none of them have died yet in the three-year study.
Really?
Yeah, we're actually quite surprised by that. Although what we think is the case is that there's so few pinyon pines left that there's very few bark beetles around, at least up here in Los Alamos.
Yeah, so you're doing it in an elevated place that has more water and lower temperatures than, say, we would have here in Albuquerque, right?
Exactly. And since so many pinyon pines died here in the early 2000s, there's just no hosts for the bark beetles. That's, of course, we're speculating on why they're still alive, and we still have to figure out the details, but they definitely are hurting pretty bad.
So do you heat and water deprive all the ones you're treating, or do you heat some and heat and water deprive others?
That's a great question. We have trees that we only heat, and trees that we only drought, and trees that we heat and drought, okay, as well as some controls.
So how do all those different categories compare?
Well, it's been fascinating. You know, again, nothing's truly died yet, so we don't have the answers from this study. But we've observed some fascinating things, such as trees that are heated this March were covered in insects, whereas none of the other trees had insects on them. So we thought, oh, boy, the heat's going to kill, you know, everything really fast. But lo and behold, all those insects are gone now, and you can't see any evidence of them. So whether or not they're more vulnerable because of the heat is still a question we're trying to sort out.
So what do you – I mean, that's all really fascinating because it's sort of – you know, it's a good reason to do experiments because it didn't turn out like you thought it was going to, right?
Right.
So what do you take from this? What's the message to listeners about this?
Well, the message from previous research is when people have heated trees, they die faster. Right, so we do expect our study to show what's been shown before in potted studies in greenhouses, which is that the heated trees should die faster than the ones that aren't heated. But yeah, it still remains to be seen, you know, from this study whether or not that's going to bear out.
So you're working only with pinyons and junipers.
Right.
What about all the other kinds of species of trees in New Mexico? How would you – you're a plant physiologist, right? You probably have some thoughts on how they would react to these same conditions.
Right, exactly. So the pinyon pine, you know, to some extent, a tree is a tree is a tree. And they have a lot of the same processes. They have those stomata on the leaves, for example, and photosynthesis and then carbohydrates. And so a lot of what we're learning from pinyon pine and juniper is very transferable to these other species. And we know that in part because we actually do measurements and studies on the other species like ponderosa pine and spruce and Douglas fir. We just don't kill them with drought experiments because it would be pretty hard to kill these huge trees. But we do other studies on those during droughts to confirm that, oh, yeah, they do behave very similarly to our pinyon pines.
So I had read somewhere before you started this experiment that there was an expectation that the heated and drought-deprived trees would be dead in 20 to 40 weeks. So what's happened is really contrary to what people thought was going to happen.
Well, the 20 to 40-week prediction comes from studies, very good studies, but studies that have been done in greenhouses.
I see.
Where you take a 20-year-old kind of small pinyon pine and put it in a pot, you know, dig it out of the ground, put it in a pot, and put it in a greenhouse, and then heat it. And those studies are really good and very mechanistic and very useful to us, but the problem is trees die much faster when you put them in a pot, right, than if they're out in the real world.
All right, so we can't really draw conclusions yet, except that it sounds like trees are much better at staying alive than we thought they would be. What does this mean for New Mexico's other plants, and what does it mean for New Mexico's agriculture, do you think, if climate change continues at its present pace and we're faced with 40% drought and 9-degree elevation in temperature?
Well, I think those are dire expectations is what I would have. I mean, in this particular case, we took what few pinyon pines we could find that were still alive up here, and we're trying to drought them. Well, they're still alive for a reason. We've picked a hard case to try to kill trees. But we do know from studies from throughout the Western North America that as temperature is increasing, so is mortality of trees. They're really tightly correlated, temperature and mortality rates. And so we can expect a lot more mortality here. We actually have predictions from multiple models now that we should expect to be relatively free of conifers or have lost the vast majority of them by 2050. So what we're looking at is a complete change in the landscape of New Mexico.
And so, and what about irrigated agriculture?
Right,
I mean, so
right.
Much of our agriculture is irrigated.
So that's a different beast, and we haven't studied that. You know, water is the limiting resource. So if we can afford to keep pumping water out of the ground or out of the Rio to irrigate our crops, then we should be able to be by quite a few more decades. But now that, of course, doesn't include the fact that insects keep evolving much faster than plants do and much faster than industry can. So there still could be major outbreaks, even in the irrigated landscapes, although I think the irrigation does buy us a lot of years.
So one of the things that when I talked to gardeners about this show and that I was going to have you on, they wanted me to ask is how much of our tree death in, say, Albuquerque or Santa Fe is due to pesticides, you know, that we're using on other things that end up adversely affecting trees?
Well, I don't know. You know, we don't study that, so I really can't speak with authority on that. But I wouldn't expect that to be a huge factor compared to the huge amount of warming and drought that we've experienced.
All right. So I know you have to run, and I know you've allocated just a certain amount of time for this interview, but I'd sort of like to ask for your takeaway. What should we be taking away from the studies you've made, and both individually and as a matter of policy, do you think?
Well, the smoking gun is rising CO2. So we can do other things to protect our forests. We can sustainably thin them. We can do prescribed burning and other activities that increase the amount of water that's available to the remaining trees after you thin out the smaller trees, for example. And those activities are really valuable and should be taken into consideration and done. But that's just a mitigating factor while the real culprit's still out there. So from a policy perspective, we need CO2 emissions to be curtailed. But that's a big challenge. It's not just America's challenge, right? That's a global problem. And it's really hard to get all the nations around the world to agree on these things, especially when people's income tends to be strongly correlated with how much CO2 emissions there is on a per-nation basis. So it's a big challenge that we're facing, and it's a global challenge.
Well, Dr. Nate McDowell, I would like to thank you so much for joining us today on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz, and we're soon to be joined by Dr. Jose Olivares. Nate, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have a second Los Alamos scientist on the phone with us right now. Dr. Jose Olivares was the executive director of the National Alliance for Advanced Biofuels, a consortium of 39 public and private institutions, all focused on algae. Dr. Olivares, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I was amazed by the results of this effort that you led, which was a three-year effort, and it somehow got the projected costs for a gallon of algae-based biofuels from $250 a gallon to $7.50 a gallon. That seems like an amazing result, particularly since algae has been studied for a long time. There have been lots of efforts to get the cost down.
Well, it is a great effort, and it's an effort of 39 institutions that partner together to do the work and show the path or some of the paths by which we can achieve that.
So I guess the beginning question would have to be, why algae? I mean, when I drive by a pond loaded with green scum, the first thing that occurs to me is not I'm going to stop my car and fill it up with algae-based fuel.
Oh, there are a lot of good reasons for using algae, and you're right. You know, you wonder, how can something that we call pond scum be utilized as fuel? But algae, like most of the plants, terrestrial plants that we use for bioenergy today, is a photosynthetic organism. It uses sunlight and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to grow. And it grows very, very nicely and very prolific. You know, we hear every day about blooms in the coasts. And these are huge blooms. In fact, a couple of months ago, there was an 800-kilometer-long bloom of algae that off the coast of Brazil, where the World Cup is happening right now. And you can imagine how much biomass is growing in that long stretch of the Brazilian coast. That biomass can be converted into fuels through many, many different processes, and that's what we're studying.
So, all right, so this is a very dumb question, but so algae contains something like oil that we use for petroleum?
Many species of algae produce lipids as part of their metabolic process, and we can extract those lipids. Those lipids are a lot like the lipids that come out of soybeans, for example, and the same processes that convert soybean fat into a transesterified methyl ester that we call biodiesel. We can convert lipid from algae into a biodiesel. There are processes today that can convert it into jet fuel, and not just the lipid itself, but the rest of the biomass that's associated with the algae.
The biomass, you mean the
green stuff.
The green stuff.
yeah, exactly.
All right. So one of the reasons I was so excited about having you on the show is that we hear a lot about, renewable energy. We hear about wind. We hear about solar. There have been tremendous gains, apparently, being made in those areas. But we don't hear much about gains in the transportation, the vehicle area, the stuff that we fill our cars with.
Right.
And so this is what's really so exciting about what you are up to, right?
Right. So I agree. We are making gains in the transportation area. We're seeing more and more hybrid cars and electric cars going on our roads, which is excellent, right? But one thing that's probably going to lag for some time is our heavy transportation fleet. Our big trucks and jets and so on are probably not going to be utilizing electricity from fuel cells or from battery systems for some time. The energy density in those cells is just too low for those heavy transportation systems. So we will.
In other words, we can run cars. We can run a Prius off a battery, but it's hard to run a big truck.
Hard to run a big truck because you're going to need so many batteries that truck is going to be carrying more batteries than actual cargo. Okay.
Right.
And similar with jet engines. If you're going to have to pile up a 787 with batteries rather than people. It's going to be very, very hard to see them fly.
And also, there's the problem that our electricity comes predominantly from coal still. So
that's correct.
That's not necessarily the answer in any event, right?
That's correct. We really do want to get away from fossil fuels like coal and petroleum. And so, as long as our electricity is primarily coming from those sources, it's going to deter our utilization of those types of fuels. So we will need renewable transportation fuels into the future, and algae biofuels can represent one of those options.
So this was a gigantic project that you headed up. You got about $50 million from the federal government. There was about $20 million, as I understand it, from private industry. So that's $70 million. You had 3 years. But what did you do to somehow get – because what you were focused on is making an efficient and energy efficient and a product that was also economical. What did you do to cause this to happen? What did the project do?
So actually we did a lot of things. And what we did is we did a lot of things and brought them together. So we looked at what is needed to produce – algal biofuels, all the way from their inception in a microcell in an organism that measures less than the size of your hair in diameter, okay, and try to understand how to maximize the biomass and lipid within that organism.
That's the size of the organism you were working with? That's
yes, in the micron size, 1 to 10 micron sizes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we primarily focused on microalgae.
Why?
Because it grows very prolific under the right conditions. Okay, microalgae, which is what you see in the seas for the most part. You go to the beaches and you can find these kelp that are meters long. Those can be used for biofuels also, but they are not as easily controlled because it takes them a long time to grow. Microalgae can double its rate in a number of hours. Some species can double their rate in a number of hours.
So that's so incredible.
It doubles it.
So the lipid content would also double in a number of hours?
Yeah, exactly. So you can actually be harvesting in a couple of weeks, and you could have, you know, in the order of 10 to 20 harvests a year.
How much oil would you have to get out of algae to make a significant difference on the CO2 that's being emitted into the air to make a difference on climate change, do you think?
Obviously, we do utilize a lot of oil for transportation fuels, okay? Only about a quarter of the CO2 that's emitted into the air comes from transportation fuels. The rest comes from fossil fuels that are utilized for electricity, for buildings, for for our infrastructure, for manufacturing, and so on. So, you know, just tackling transportation fuels by itself to curb climate change through CO2 emissions is not going to be good enough. The best we can do with algae and with any kind of bioenergy crop is come close to CO2 emissions neutral. In other words, you know, these liquid transportation fuels will still emit CO2. But the neat thing about using a plant or algae is that they actually utilize CO2 from the atmosphere to grow. So we can recycle that CO2 back into the oil that we are consuming. Okay? So in the best case scenario, we could be CO2 emissions neutral.
So if we meet that criteria, right, and if we also continue to have the success with wind and solar, I mean, do you think we're going to actually be able to make a difference on the climate change curve so that we're not exposed to what Nate predicted for New Mexico, which is a 9-degree increase in temperature and a 40% decrease in precipitation in the next, say, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, so we have to, okay? It's not can we. We have to do that. We have to meet different emission standards. If we don't, we're up against a very, very troublesome future, okay? So it's not, in my opinion, we better do this. And it's going to come from utilization of photovoltaic cells, utilization of wind energy, biofuels from bioenergy, and also energy efficiency. Actually, the biggest impact we can make today that we have at our hands today is energy efficiency. And I don't think we are taking enough advantage of that area.
So let me just follow up with that final thought. So what should we be doing as policymakers? What should we be doing as individuals to pursue this energy efficiency that you just mentioned?
I think new standards. We should all be conscious as to how much we drive, but also how we build our next building or how we build our next factory, and so on. Everything that we can do to save a gallon of petroleum or a ton of coal from being pumped out of the ground will make a difference.
Dr. Jose Olivares, thank you very much for joining us today on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you, and I think you're going to make your meeting.
Thank you.
I would like to thank both of my guests so much for accommodating us today, Drs. Nate McDowell and Jose Olivares. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White. Our executive producer is Lynn Shebeki. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. I'm Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this show are downloadable under Stephen Spitz at iTunes. Archives of all my shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.